Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Hey, Tim, good to see you.
Mike, good to see you. How's everything going?
Going well. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. Today, we were going to talk a little bit about defense and national security innovation and bridging the valley of death, which we'll explain what that means in a minute. And then there's actually a more recent development than just talking in general about innovation. That's the announcement by Deputy Secretary of Defense Hicks about the Pentagon's Replicator program, which actually ties in perfectly to our first thoughts for this episode about innovation and new and cool emerging technologies and more rapidly fielding production systems in order to meet current warfighter needs.
It's a timely topic. It's an important topic. It's one that, frankly, the U.S. military has been sort of looking to close, if you will, the loop between identification of need and the fielding of solution for, you know, decades, but certainly since 9/11. And if you look at the speed with which innovation and innovative solutions and technologies were fielded in Iraq and Afghanistan, it closed a lot of that. But now I think what you want to talk about today, Mike, is sort of the way that the Defense Department has gone about trying to institutionalize some of that and to build some of the learning of the past 20 years into the way that we do business more generally. Is that a good way of framing it?
Yeah, that's a great way of framing it. And also the way you mentioned it in terms of sort of post 9/11 and our operations in Iraq and Afghanistan kind of set the stage for that, right? So we had, during that period, we had rapid acquisition type programs because we had ongoing operations in certain zones. One of the things in Army acquisition I did a long time ago were things where we were working with special operations community because their acquisition professionals inherently have both the expertise and frankly, the authorities to rapidly acquire products and services for, you know, urgent warfighter needs because of the special operations mission. And particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, in the early phases there, that was needed. But even though we were on a war footing, there weren't really necessarily rapid acquisition processes. And again, this is when it was an Army acquisition, so I can't speak to the Navy or the Air Force or the rest, but at least on the Army side, we identified the need for up-armoring the Humvees, you know, doing the MRAPs and all that. That was a little bit of a mess initially because it was sort of, we'd already deployed vehicles to the theater and now we needed to change that. That you could just hear like the grinding metal as we sort of like turned around. If folks, listeners, remember back in the days is when Strikers, the light armored vehicles were kind of like the big Army push. I think Army Future Combat Systems was still kind of a thing. So to have to admit that the Strikers weren't really doing it and we needed to kind of change some things around and we needed to, instead of move fast with Humvees, we needed to up armor them, you know, took some thinking, took some changes. Obviously got there, but that is a good point I wanted to make here in the early stages back then that, you know, the ability to innovate and to rapidly adapt to a changing scenario and then deploy something we still weren't good at back then, even that, right? Fast forward to a little bit closer in time, but still a while back, I want to mention the creation of DIU or the Defense Innovation Unit. That was in 2015. And at the time, I'll tell you, I think I heard plenty of people say, interesting idea, it's not going to last. I'm happy to say that what was DIUX, X for experimental, has been DIU now, not experimental, and they're still around. And so, you know, we're getting up on 7, 8, 9 years now. And DIU is still there, which I find very impressive. So DIU was the idea of Ash Carter, former SecDef Ash Carter, though I think back at the time, he was Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition years ago, so he gets this whole world. And the idea was we're going to create this like Silicon Valley outpost, physically in Silicon Valley, called DIUX, which will be a direct interface between the defense and technology communities, kind of in the ways we would have done years ago with, you know, DARPA and the creation of the internet and things like that. But it not happened actually in a long time. There's a whole different discussion about sort of distrust between the tech community and the defense establishment going back many years. This was an attempt to sort of fix those bridges, but also leaving aside if you're a tech company or a bending metal type company, it was connecting with commercial companies. A point we've made often on the podcast, right, is things like interesting, critical, and emerging technologies that are inherently dual use that aren't necessarily what you think of as a weapon system. DIU was all about that at the beginning. So they go out there and sort of have a need statement. They request white papers. They were going to be the interface node between entrepreneurs and startup technologies and commercial tech companies. And then they would, you know, take the cool ideas they received, the proposals they received, the vehicle that they still use today, which we've worked on a lot, are OTAs, other transaction agreements, which I'll put this on the record. I'm a big fan of OTAs, despite being a traditional government contracts lawyer, because they don't use the Federal Acquisition Regulation or FAR or standard clauses. They are more commercial-like, but they're still a government agreement, so you still have to kind of work with them a bit. But DIU was very successful getting these OTAs out there. And so they connect the cool tech idea with, you know, a defense component, and you can sort of, then you can get a follow-on production contract, get follow-on work. It was, I think, very successful. There's an office in Boston now too, instead of just Silicon Valley. And that's the history of DIU.
Now, do they provide seed capital the way that InQtel does, for instance, or do they sort of pop in at a later stage of the process, so to speak?
Yeah, so that's a great sort of segue, Tim, into another part. Is this, so DIU is sort of the interface and the connector, and then the money for ongoing production comes from usually a typical government, DOD contracting entity. But since DIU in 2015, and I admit this was kind of new to me about 2 years ago, where we did some research on this, the U.S. government, largely in the defense space, but in others, has sort of, there's this like spider web of other innovation type programs out there now, including sort of the startup and venture capital type stuff that's out there. And I'd like to feel that DIU kind of sparked a lot of this stuff. So there's technology accelerators out there. TechStars is out there for, that's for space companies. There's the challenge programs like AFWERX and SOFWERX, that's Air Force and Special Forces entities. There's challenge.gov too, which I think is not just DOD, it's everybody that are out there. There's the Hyperspace Challenge. I think that's still out there. And then you got things like the Defense Innovation Marketplace, which I think there's a website for that, which links, you know, industry with all sorts of different places in the DoD ecosystem. And there's also...
And those are all pots of money or so attached
it's
to pots
a little
of money?
Different. Some of them are flat out, here's a pot of money. Like it'll say, we are going to, you know, issue grants or contracts, bid on this. Some of them are challenges. So you get money if you like win the challenge. And some of them are incubators, which, you know, is, again, something the U.S. government hasn't done that much. You said InQtel is an example of the intelligence community, a similar idea. A lot of these are defense related, but there's like dozens of these now. And if I go back to DIU being created in 2015, it's kind of it, other than DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, and you have equivalent component in the intelligence community with IARPA. But there's a whole bunch of other stuff out there now, which was one of the main points I think we wanted to bring up here, is that, you know, industry, you can always pursue the traditional sort of government contracts approach, but there's a lot of other stuff out here now that the U.S. government has put out. All I was going to mention is related to SecDef Hicks' speech the other day about Replicator. There's a Innovation Pathways website by DOD. I just searched Innovation Pathways to our listeners. And it's the result of work conducted by the Innovation Steering Group at DOD. So all the stuff I just mentioned kind of grew up sort of on its own with different services, different components of DOD after DIU. And then recently DOD got this Innovation Steering Group together, run by Deputy SecDef Hicks and the Secretary of Defense for Research Engineering, Heidi Shu, and the Chief Technology Officer. And they got together and they just sort of tracked where is all this stuff, by the way, sort of get around it. And there's kind of like I'm going to use the wrong term for it, but it's like a spider web map that you can zoom in and out of that shows all the connections across innovation organizations, government entities, UARCs, University Affiliated Research, all the stuff. But anyway, the whole ecosystem, the point I want to make for listeners, the whole ecosystem here is a lot bigger and there's a lot more going on than there would have been, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago. And there are a lot more opportunities to get into things here now, right? as you said, the competitions, challenges, pots of money, connected, get connected with customers. There's a lot of good stuff out there.
And a lot of that's, I mean, is clearly being driven by the pace of technological change and the fact that, as you and I have discussed in a few of the podcasts that we've done, sort of some of the lessons that we've learned from Ukraine, for instance. And, you know, that I think was uppermost in the deputy secretary's mind when she rolled out the replicator initiative. And I know you mentioned that a couple of minutes ago, so I thought I'd go ahead and just sort of briefly tell our listeners what it is. So this was a speech in late August where Kathleen Hicks sort of proposed a fleet of small, attritable, uncrewed systems across multiple domains that would begin to be fielded over the next 18 to 24 months. And essentially, it's meant to change the way that the DoD buys weapons and the way that we sort of conceive of warfare, if you will, in the 21st century. And you and I were talking before we got on the air this afternoon that, you know, for years and years, the U.S. trend has always been to buy the absolute outer edge of technological advancement, no matter what the price. And then to, you know, wait until that the decisive advantage that that gave us had sort of worn off, and then to leap forward another generation. And this is, I think, a very different concept of warfare that I think really comes off the Ukrainian battlefield.
Yeah, that's a good hook into one of our earlier podcasts. We talked about lessons learned from the Ukraine battlefield, which we talked about some of the points that I believe DepSecDef Hicks actually mentioned in her speech, were things like the use of commercial drones, the use of, you know, social media for targeting, you know, Russian opponents. We talked about all that months ago. And that's exactly the sort of thing that Hicks said in her speech, that, you know, we've seen in Ukraine what low-cost, attritable systems can do, not to mention other commercial technologies. And attritable, I keep wanting to say attributable, but that's not right. But attritable, right, Tim, I think they mean is sort of, you know, can be used up, can be destroyed. It's not meant long-term, right? Like, we expect the drone to fall from the sky eventually, right?
Yes, I forgot the number of drones that are being lost in Ukraine every month, you know, aside from the suicide drones, and it's enormous. So these are, you know, meant to be essentially disposable,
yeah,
which is completely antithetical to the way that the U.S. has waged war for the last 75 years.
Yeah, you and I were talking about, that's really another point that I think Hicks had said in her speech was, you know, these are not intended to be systems, ships or aircraft we use for the next 30 to 50 years. These are systems we might use for 3 to 5 years before we move on to the next thing, as we should, given, you know, dealing with a fast moving adversary and the pace of innovation. And that's exactly the point you were making earlier, that this is really a cultural change in the Pentagon, and ties to the innovation points I was making earlier. This is kind of, this is where history has now taken us with this innovation change in the defense establishment. Is now Secretary Hicks is saying, we're going to try to field these, you know, mass waves of these smaller systems that we expect to get used up. It's not, this is interesting, and I think in the speech notes, it's not a new program of record. This is not a program like, you know, Patriot for air defense, or, you know, the name of a new plane or a ship. It's a cultural change in how the Pentagon does rapid acquisition here. They got to keep up with sort of the pace of innovation. So there's no, Tim, we should mention something. I mentioned the Valley of Death, but I realized we didn't explain that. So like earlier on, I mentioned Valley of Death at the beginning of our discussion. That's the term for, you've got a cool idea and there's some R&D and you've probably even made a prototype. And that historically, this is where the department has recognized they have problems. You've got that prototype, and there's a need for it, probably, or there wouldn't have been the prototype, maybe. And then there's this gap where there's no funding for it. It doesn't become a program of record. You know, years or more go by. And the Valley of Death, we usually mean the Valley of Death, you know, it isn't just the death of the idea or the prototype. It's often the death of the company. So that gets back to the point I made about DIU and these other innovation entities that DoD has out there, where there's pots of money or challenges or the rest. There's this plan to sort of bridge the valley of death, because a company could come up with a really cool technology, but historically, if it wasn't going to get funded and it wasn't going to be a program of record, they have nobody to sell it to because they developed it maybe for DoD's use, and then they're kind of stuck. And multiple times, Secretary Hicks said that this new idea is meant to also help bridge the valley of death, right? So no specifics yet, but it sort of carries this point along that if we're going to go out there and try to get this technology, probably already existing, probably already commercial, or if it's not already existing, how do we rapidly, you know, get prototypes built and acquire them? That's going to be another, you know, bridge effort, right, between developing the idea and then actually deploying the capability.
Right, because the current system in a lot of ways, if you think about it, really punishes failure. You know, you have a lot of the startup companies and, you know, you think about this, you know, especially in like the space realm, right, where the barriers to entry are inordinately high. You go out, you spend years raising money, you develop technology, you launch, 90 seconds later, there is an anomaly, you know, they have to destroy the rocket. And you're never going to launch again because you don't have enough money to do it again because you didn't make it up the first time. As we all know, the road to success is paved with failure. And there needs to be, so it's not only a financial valley of death, if you will, it's also kind of a valley of death of innovation and ideas, you know, and that there's all these things that if you make that effort to get to the, you know, step one, you might as well push it over and ensure that you can get, you know, to the next step. I'm a big proponent of that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of this approach as well. And I was just generally just pleased to hear everything that Hicks said a few weeks ago. I think she also had some comments about, again, it itself is not a program of record. We're not creating a new bureaucracy. We're not even asking for new money. We're sort of trying to smooth the processes we already have so we can move faster. And I find that very interesting. I'd like to, you know, like to know more specifics, but that's kind of what we're talking about in terms of innovation. And I think the innovation steering group we were just talking about, Hicks has mentioned, that's kind of part of all this. DIU, which is why we mentioned DIU in the beginning of the podcast, is also part of this. All sort of the big innovation players in DoD in the recent years are part of this. And I think there was one line Hicks said that was interesting. Was about, it's not just about, you know, replicating producing the products, replicating the best practices to get the products, to get the military advantage faster. That to me is like an acquisition reform piece right there. Is, and they've looked at this with the steering group, as I understand it, like, what are the best practices among DIU and the Strategic Capabilities Office and all these entities we mentioned earlier on to sort of rapidly acquire things, rapidly field them and all that. And then they will replicate, as part of the program here, the best practices to do that. So it's fascinating because first thing you see the headline, you think it maybe like replicator means the drone system because this is a large amount of autonomous systems. No, not a specific drone system. It's the way we're going to get them is at least the way I'm reading it.
No, that's fascinating. I want to ask you about what I think is actually the longest pole in this tent, which is cultural, you know, which is changing sort of the way that DoD professionals think about acquiring technology, sort of the relationship between prime contractors and subs. Because so many of the types of innovation and technology that I think you and I have seen from clients that we've worked with at Hogan is that these great, you know, small technology companies are destined to either become permanent subcontractors on a system that they could be a prime on, or they just get bought out outright by a larger company and just sort of become part of the conglomerate. So, you know, what do you see, you know, the cultural hurdles here, and do you see shifts ongoing?
Yeah, there's a couple things to unpack in there. Let me take the first one about the shifts. I feel I've at least seen, you know, compared to prior time in Army acquisition and other spots, DIU, for example, the Strategic Capabilities Office, and the use of OTAs, other transaction agreements, has been, I think, more successful than maybe folks would have thought, you know, 10 years ago or so. But there's a good example that, as you talk about the acquisition workforce, they're not a contract officer you're dealing with an OTA. They're an agreements officer because it's not a contract under the FAR. And that's still kind of challenging. Like the government contracting workforce, the acquisition community in the government, you know, has very particular training, very particular qualifications, and very particular powers. And we'd have to turn this into a government contracts, you know, particular 101 lesson. Our government contracts team at Hogan has other materials on that that folks are welcome to look at. But to get the contracting officers to think a little differently about how to do this, they've definitely gotten better. But yes, it's still a challenge. Obviously, but at least, you know, when you look at who the ultimate customer is, the program managers and the, you know, the warfighter, they want the stuff. And what we often still see, you know, is them going to the agreement or contracts person being like, what's the holdup? Like, what do we need to do? So they're not causing any issues about the new ways of doing things, whether it's an OTA or some other type of agreement. But yes, the acquisition workforce, I think, needs to think a little differently than they would have been trained to do. That's always kind of been a challenge, but I'm optimistic about that because we've seen some great stuff come out of OTAs and some very creative thinking. I don't think that would have really been possible like 20 years ago. So that's helpful. On the companies themselves, that's an interesting point about like technology companies sort of always destined to be a subcontractor or maybe get absorbed by a bigger company. I don't see anything right now where DoD or Hicks has said anything about that, which is interesting because there's always been concern about competition in the DoD marketplace and the DoD ecosystem. SBIR awards, Small Business Innovation Research, SBIR awards, is sort of the cool way for cool and emerging technology companies to get involved. But the history on that has still been, there's still the valley of death because the SBIR award is still at the R&D phase. So Hicks' announcement doesn't really solve it in that way. Like if I'm a small technology company, if I'm a new tech startup, how, you know, based on the programs we're talking about here, the processes we're talking about here, how do I, you know, grow to be a prime contractor? How do I protect my stuff? Or how do I not get bought out by somebody? I don't see a lot of that right now with DoD. I think that's still probably a concern. It'd be interesting to see as this program comes out, if they address that.
Well, how do you scale up? I mean, I think that's the, you know, that's another concern, right? You build that better mousetrap, you know, they want more of them, but you can't, you know, provide the number required, you know, in the time that they expect. And there's got to be a way to help at both ends of that. Because to me, you know, look, we have advantages vis-a-vis our potential opponents and our ability to innovate and our ability to turn around and field those innovations quickly. I mean, that could end up being decisive at some point. And, you know, as a country, you know, we need to be doing everything that we can to be doing that for ourselves. And I assume that others are going to be doing it for themselves as well. You know, I'm assuming they're having the same sorts of discussions somewhere in, you know, not necessarily in law firms, but ministries of defense or think tanks in other countries. So,
yeah, that reminds me, we actually touched on this with our episode with Charles Mathias. We talked about telecom issues. We kind of mentioned innovation and tech briefly in our discussion there. Reminded we mentioned Diana, which I don't think I ever spelled out. So I can do it now. That's the NATO Defense Innovation Accelerator for the North Atlantic Initiative. It's relatively new. I think they announced the idea a couple of years ago, but earlier in 2023, now they formally said like NATO, the NATO Diana Initiative will bring together personnel within the alliance and startups and scientific research and technology companies to solve critical defense and security challenges. Like that's great to see. I mean, that's where everything we just talked about in the DoD and the US piece, right? Now we see it here across the alliance. So you've got everyone, you know, the North Atlantic Alliance doing this and bringing everyone together. I am cautiously optimistic about that, considering how well DoD has actually been doing on their stuff. I know that Heidi Shu, the, you know, Undersecretary of Defense for Research and R&D, is involved in the Diana Initiative, and she's done a great job on all that. So we've got that going on, I think, with allies now. That would be interesting to see how that plays out in terms of, we mentioned these emerging technology companies. You know, what if they're actually providing their tech through the NATO alliance, not just the DoD? That's a great opportunity to grow. And also, you know, it doesn't have to be U.S. companies too. It's allied companies. Again, cautiously optimistic. This all sounds really like really good stuff.
Nope. I think anything, you know, that NATO can do in sort of the current focus, if you will, in Europe on security to help nurture their own tech ecosystem, I think is actually ultimately good for the alliance and for sort of, you know, tech innovation and, you know, generally.
Well, do we have any final remarks on this new program of the Replicator Initiative?
No, I think it's, you know, obviously the proof is going to be in, you know, the funding and, you know, and whether it has, you know, full congressional buy-in and, you know, what it produces in the out years. But I think that it's a great, you know, step forward. You know, there's not a lot of detail yet, and I look forward to seeing more in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, and I think one of the last comments I'll make on it is, in addition to the cultural change and sort of the process that we were so focused on, you know, to be clear for our listeners, the idea in these, we have a new acronym. I can't resist throwing out an acronym in the defense world because we always got them, right? ADA2, we've mentioned before, it's the All Domain Attributable Autonomy. So everyone's got to get used to saying ADA2 now. That's what this is all about, which is, you know, could be fleets of self-piloting ships, uncrewed aircraft, uncrewed, you know, logistics vehicles. That's the vision for what these things are all going to be. Now, that's a whole nother discussion, you know, talk about drones or uncrewed vehicles and maybe also AI again, right? Like, where's the AI component in these autonomous systems? So I'll kind of leave that at the end, is that we've talked about the acquisition reform piece, right? And I'm excited about the innovation piece. But as we learn more about this, what autonomous systems is the Pentagon looking to get, right? What are they actually going to go out there and try to do? And it's in multiple domains, land, sea, air, space, maybe all of that. So that'll be interesting.
Sounds like a topic for another podcast.
So we'll see what we hear from what DoD puts out there public when we'll pick it up again. So, well, Tim, have a great weekend.
Same to you, Mike. Have a great weekend. And thank you all for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.